Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Herald podcast, normally recorded in our studio at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre, currently recorded from our volunteers' homes. To keep in touch with us, use our social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram and Twitter, which are all at Q and Review. That's CUEANDREVIEW. Or get in touch via information at qandreview.com. That's information at CUEANDREVIEW.com. Please like and share our podcasts and give us any constructive feedback.
The Herald, Tuesday the 25th of May 2021. News. Decriminalising personal drug use would be considered in independent Scotland. This article is by Alistair Grant. Decriminalising drugs for personal use would be considered in an independent Scotland under radical plans put forward by the SNP. The new report also proposes moving away from council tax and introducing a land value tax. Elsewhere, it said eradicating poverty will help to unlock our economic potential. The Scottish Tories said the wish list was not remotely credible. The Social Justice and Fairness Commission was set up by Nicola Sturgeon in 2019 to present a route map for delivering a fairer Scotland. The SNP said it is not a predetermined list of policy decisions for an independent Scotland, but rather a model for inclusive decision making. It was led by MSP Shona Robinson, who is Scotland's new Social Justice Secretary, and Neil Gray. The report called for a fresh approach to supporting those living with drug addiction. It said transformational change that is long-lasting and successful needs to be rooted in consensus. We would therefore propose utilisation of a citizens' assembly to look at issues such as decriminalisation for personal use, which we could advance with independence in our efforts to tackle addiction. It said an independent commission featuring drug users and addicts should be created to build consensus across political parties and wider society about the drug laws and policies of an independent country. The report also backed trialling safe consumption rooms with a view to expansion if it proves effective. It said tackling poverty should be the single most important ambition that the government of an independent Scotland could seek to achieve. Calling for a fairer, bespoke approach to immigration in Scotland, the report argued the UK government's pernicious drive to reduce migration and barriers to entry create insecurity and undermine communities. Raising issues such as depopulation in some parts of the country, it added, its relentless pursuit of a hostile environment is inhumane and ineffective, and entirely at odds with Scotland's needs. Instead, the report proposed allowing free movement, with visa schemes that benefit rural and remote areas at risk of depopulation, allowing asylum seekers to work and create an independent agency to adjudicate on asylum applications. On tax, the report supported widespread reform of the tax system, with more progressive taxation, so higher earners pay more, as well as the greater use of taxes to address the climate emergency. It backed a land value tax as part of a reformed property taxation system that could remove our dependence on council tax, land and buildings transaction tax, LBTT, and non-domestic rates. Exploring the issue of a universal basic income, a minimum income for everyone without means testing, the report said there are significant potential advantages, but identified practical and complex issues with the idea. Setting out plans for a democratic renewal, it suggested agreeing, defining, and enshrining our shared values and goals in a written constitution. Scottish Conservative MSP Miles Briggs said this wish list from the SNP is not remotely credible. Their election manifesto wasn't costed, and this blueprint for their vision of a future Scotland isn't either. It is based on fantasy economics. They simply don't accept the reality that independence would already cost Scottish families thousands of pounds before their plans to spend even more public money. He added, this report also talks up a raft of policies that the SNP have the powers at their disposal right now to tackle. We've heard it all before from SNP ministers on scrapping or reforming council tax during their 14 years in office. It was also Nicola Sturgeon who took her eye off the ball in relation to drug deaths and slashed funding for vital rehabilitation services. They don't need drugs laws to be devolved to fix that right now. The Scottish public deserve the SNP's focus to be on our recovery from COVID rather than talking up their plans for an independent Scotland. This article is by Alistair Grant. The Herald, Tuesday the 25th of May 2021. News. Glasgow Airline reconnects Scotland and Wales. This article is by Scott Wright. Loganair has bolstered its network for the second time in less than a week by adding a new flight connecting Scotland and Wales. The Scottish airline will begin flying between Edinburgh and Cardiff 5 times per week from August the 2nd. It is the latest of the major domestic routes to be re-established by Loganair and other airlines following the collapse of regional carrier Flybe in March of last year. Last week, Loganair said it would pick up the former Flybe routes connecting Glasgow and Edinburgh with Exeter Airport in Devon. Loganair began selling tickets for the new Edinburgh to Cardiff flight today. It will service the route on its 49-seat Embraer 145 regional jets, with the journey expected to take 1 hour and 25 minutes. The airline already connects Edinburgh with destinations, including Southampton, Newquay and the Isle of Man. Kay Ryan, Loganair's chief commercial officer, said, I know many of our customers, both business and leisure, have been waiting for this service to resume, and we are very pleased to be able to add Cardiff to our Edinburgh roster. Importantly, these services fill gaps left by the collapse of Flybe, with almost every lost domestic destination now being restored by Loganair and other carriers over the coming months. Kate Sherry, aviation director at Edinburgh Airport, said, we're excited to be reconnecting the capitals of Scotland and Wales, a route which will allow family members to reunite, as well as enable people to enjoy a well-earned break in Edinburgh and Cardiff. It's been an extremely tough period, and we know people are looking forward to enjoying some time away from home, and this is further good news as the airport looks to provide those opportunities for our passengers. Loganair is a valued partner and its confidence in Edinburgh Airport is welcome now and going forward. This article is by Scott Wright.
Recorded from the Herald on the 26th of May 2021. From the sports section. Celtic provide update on manager hunt as they detail failed announcement plans. By Aidan Smith. Celtic have responded to a number of fan questions over the announcement of their new manager. The Parkhead club say that they had hoped to announce Neil Lennon's successor ahead of their season ticket renewal details. But after revealing season ticket details today, the club have given Parkhead supporters an update on the current situation. They wrote on Twitter, "We had hoped to have announced the manager before providing this update. However, we must now begin the renewal process to allow us to prepare for a phased and safe return to Celtic Park for our supporters. Thank you for your support." Meanwhile, Celtic will offer all season ticket holders a £50 club retail voucher as part of their added value proposition to supporters, in a move believed to be costing the club up to £2.5 million. Celtic have been under pressure to reward fans for their support last season during the COVID shutout and have released details of the added extras included in next term's season tickets as they look to make good on that promise. Celtic will freeze season ticket prices, and Herald Sport understands that streams of their first Champions League qualifying tie and the friendly clashes with Preston North End and West Ham will be included, as well as the three ties during their pre-season training camp in Wales. With uncertainty still surrounding the admittance of fans to stadiums, access will also be given to streaming of matches. That article was by Aidan Smith. Recorded from the Herald on the 26th of May 2021. From the sports section, Andrzej Kudela to miss UEFA Euro 2020 after losing racism appeal, by Joshua Barry. Andrzej Kudela has lost an appeal against his 10-match ban for racially abusing Rangers' Glenn Kamara. The dismissal means Kudela will be unable to represent the Czech Republic in the upcoming European Championships. The 34-year-old was found guilty of calling Kamara a F...... monkey in Rangers' second-round tie with Slavia Prague in the Europa League by the UEFA Control Ethics and Disciplinary Board. Kudela subsequently appealed the ruling that found him guilty of using racist language and maintained that he had only used offensive language towards the Finnish midfielder. The Czech Republic faced Scotland in their tournament opener at Hampden Park on June 14th. In a statement, UEFA said, "The appeal lodged by Mr. Andrzej Kudela has been dismissed. Consequently, the UEFA Control Ethics and Disciplinary Board's CEDB decision of 14th of April 2021 is confirmed. The CEDB had decided to suspend SK Slavia Praha player Mr. Andrzej Kudela for the next 10 UEFA club and representative team competition matches for which he would be otherwise be eligible to play for racist behaviour." That article was by Joshua Barry.
Herald Scotland recorded on Wednesday, 26th of May 2021. Arts and Entertainments. The Tethered God by Barry Condon. Fury by Catherine Heyman. Lefanu's Angel by Brian Keogh. Paperback Reviews by Alistair Mabbitt. The Tethered God, Barry Condon. Sparsel, £9.99. More than 4,500 years ago, Egyptian Prince Khafre watches happily as his father's body is prepared for mummification. He hated his father and enjoys seeing him disemboweled. Flash forward to the present and Khafre has been reincarnated as a police dog trained to sniff out explosives. While trying to get to grips with this disappointing new world, he searches back through his previous life in a bid to understand why the gods would have reincarnated him as a German shepherd. It's an original idea which would still be readable in lesser hands, but is elevated by Condon's narrative voice. In a book where almost every sentence is steeped in black humour, the snarky tone of an entitled princeling, trying first forge a path through his own world and then to make sense of the 21st century from the perspective of a dog, rubs up against modern sensibilities in inventive and delightful ways. Fury, Catherine Heyman. Myriad, £8.99. Heyman's father's nickname for her was Little Fury, and this memoir tells of how she learned to live up to it after failing to be the kind of girl that fits. Her younger self tried to escape a background of deprivation and domestic violence through books, without ever finding the female role models she sought. After years of suffering under a misogynistic culture, epitomised by a failed rape prosecution and the blaming and shaming that followed, the 20-year-old Australian drifted through poorly paid jobs, finally finding work on the trawler Ocean Thief in the Timor Sea. Joining up as a cook, she was demoted to deckhand and took on backbreaking physical work as the only woman on the five-strong crew, after which she was able to face the world reborn and empowered. Heyman's seventh novel is a moving, inspiring memoir of overcoming trauma and misogyny and becoming the hero of one's own story at last. Lefanu's Angel, Brian Keogh, Daedalus, £11.99. Kieran Sheridan Lefanu, Dublin advertising executive and namesake of the famous author, wakes from a coma following a serious car accident, but even concussion can't explain what's going on around him. He's attacked by an intruder no one else sees. Events of a full day seem to be compressed into the space of 2 hours. A patient who was never there dies in his room, and he gains the protection of a beautiful guardian angel. Kieran begins to suspect that he's actually died, and what he's experiencing is some limbo world between life and death. Kieran's debut novel is a gripping and audaciously effective supernatural thriller, which pits his protagonist against savage spectral entities from a realm of the dead, in conflicts which toughen him up for the equally crucial battles in the boardroom of his advertising agency. Through all the mayhem and gore, Keogh's tongue is never far from his cheek. By Alistair Mabbitt.
Recorded from the Herald on the 27th of May 2021, from the sports section. Celtic fan group Green Brigade release statement on Parkhead season ticket situation, by Aidan Smith. Celtic fan group The Green Brigade have urged supporters to hold off on renewing season tickets amid uncertainty over the Parkhead managerial situation. Celtic have told fans they intend to appoint their new manager shortly, as they announced a £50 gift voucher for supporters who renew their season tickets. The Hoops have yet to name the successor to Neil Lennon, who resigned in February, although former Bournemouth boss Eddie Howe remains the frontrunner. There were no fans allowed inside Celtic Park last season due to the coronavirus restrictions. However, the Parkhead club, noting that spectators will be allowed inside Hampden Park for the delayed 2020 European Championships this summer, hope fans can return for the new campaign when a new management team will be in place. The North Curve Celtic reacted to the season ticket renewal statement on their Twitter page, saying, "We share the frustration of many around the season ticket launch and plan to consult NCC members ASAP. We'll also speak with other fans' organisations to discuss a joined-up approach. In the meantime, we'd encourage all in the North Curve to hold off renewing their season ticket." That article was by Aidan Smith. Recorded from the Herald on the 27th of May 2021. From the sports section, St Johnson to demand record transfer fee for Celtic-linked midfielder, by James Kearney. Celtic have been warned St Johnson will demand a record-breaking transfer fee to let Ali McCann depart Callum Davidson's Cup double winners. The Premiership runners-up have been keeping tabs on the Northern Ireland internationalist for months and could make their move once a new manager is finally installed at Parkhead. However, Saints chairman Steve Brown is adamant the 21-year-old will not be going on the cheap. Current manager Davidson still holds the record for the highest transfer fee banked by the McDermott outfit following his £1.75 million move to Blackburn back in 1998, and Brown says it will take more to persuade him to release McCann. "There's been a huge amount of interest in Ali," he told Radio Clyde. "He's been consistent over the last two seasons and is going away with Northern Ireland on international duty. He's played against Italy in the last international break, and he's a class act. Our transferred record is £1.75 million, and Ali will not be leaving for any less than that. We don't want players to leave when we have a successful team. Selling players is one thing, but replacing them is another. It's a huge challenge to get the same calibre of player back in. It has been a dream season for Saints on the back of Davidson's Hampden heroics. Tommy Wright's former number two overcame a tricky start to make history by leading St Johnson to both the Betfred Cup and Scottish Cup in his rookie year as boss. And Brown expects it will not be long before he starts receiving calls from potential suitors interested in securing Davidson's services too. I don't think there's a limit to what Callum can achieve," he said. "He's demonstrated what he can do with a club the size of St Johnson with limited resources, what can be achieved. He's very good at his job. He's meticulous, he knows the game inside out. I think he will kick on now. I prefer if he stayed here, but the reality is that if he keeps doing well, he will move on. It was a difficult first few months for Callum, but I wasn't concerned because I like to think I know a little bit about football. The way we were playing, we were creating loads and loads of chances. But yeah, I did have to speak to Callum. As usual with football fans, there's a lot of negativity going about it's the wrong guy we've appointed and everything else. I just told him to blanket the noise, concentrate on what he was doing, and don't pay any attention to the negativity. If anyone is going to decide whether he goes or stays, it was myself, and I told him he had my backing 100%. That article was by James Kearney.
Herald Scotland recorded on Thursday, 27th of May 2021. Arts and Entertainments. Patrick McGrath's novel about a man haunted by ghosts of the Spanish Civil War is compelling, by Malcolm Forbes. Last Days in Cleaver Square. Patrick McGrath, Hutchinson, £16.99. Review by Malcolm Forbes. Patrick McGrath's 1989 debut novel, The Grotesque, heralded the arrival of a true master of the macabre, set in a mouldering English manor and revolving around the misfortunes of a family and the machinations of their butler, the book was a slim yet immensely satisfying slice of modern Gothic fiction. It delivered shocks through murder, blackmail and a mysterious disappearance, but also elicited laughter in the dark. Since then, McGrath has continued to produce novels which plunge his reader into chilly hells. His protagonists including psychiatrists, brackets asylum, trauma, close brackets, or psychiatric patients, brackets spider, close brackets, afflicted by past horrors or grappling with present obsessions. Some pose a risk to others, most are a danger to themselves. Each book's narrative is propelled by astute character dynamics and expertly calibrated levels of suspense. McGrath's latest novel is a departure of sorts from the norm. On this occasion, he dispenses with big thrills, nasty surprises and queasy tension. Which is not to say that Last Days in Cleaver Square is low wattage. Far from it, McGrath charts the wayward progress of an old man at the end of his life as he comes to terms with what he has lost and what he has left. He has his demons and is plagued by a ghoul. It could have been a wickedly disturbing tale, instead it is a profoundly moving one, and is all the better for it. Almost 40 years have elapsed since Francis McNulty walked out one midsummer morning to tend the wounded in Spain during the Civil War. "I saw things nobody should ever have to see," he declares. Now in London in 1975, he is seeing things that only he can see. Recently, while sitting in a bus, he spotted that corpulent little monstrosity, General Franco, on Lambeth Bridge. Then the Generalissimo turned up in his garden and in his house, his uniform shabby, his boots dirty, and his face streaked with tears. Francis's daughter Gillian assures him it is an apparition, as Franco is dying in Spain. Increasingly concerned, she summons Francis's artist sister Finty from her retreat on the Isle of Mull for loyal support and also asks her fiancé, fellow civil servant Percy, if her father can join them in the marital home. But Francis has no plans to sell his beloved house in Cleaver Square and swap his personal freedom for internment. By staying put and listening to the uninvited guest in the wing chair by his bed, he hopes to understand what kind of a monster he was. However, it is Francis who opens up when a journalist arrives in the scene and interviews him about his experiences in Spain all those years ago. What begins as a vivid account of his time as an ambulance driver during the Siege of Madrid soon turns into what is both a tragic story of betrayal and loss and a guilt-fueled, grief-ravaged confession. Francis comes to realise that only by visiting Spain again can he confront his past, but will a return trip bring true closure or open old wounds? Once again, McGrath teases his reader with the testimony of an unreliable narrator, in this case one whose reality has become warped by hallucination. Francis, an unjustly neglected poet, may have lost his mind just as he lost his muse, and yet he retains a firm grip on his memories, unfolding in either short fragments or long flashbacks. They powerfully convey the atrocities he witnessed in Spain, together with the events which led to the death of the one man I ever truly loved. This is a compelling novel, rich in beauty and insight. Francis might write himself off as old, mad, haunted, but for the reader he's vitally and thrillingly alive. By Malcolm Forbes. Herald Scotland, recorded on Thursday, 27th of May, 2021. Arts and Entertainments. Review. Jess Dandy and Malcolm Martineau at Perth Concert Hall by Keith Bruce. Music. Jess Dandy and Malcolm Martineau, Perth Concert Hall, Keith Bruce. Whatever else was happening in Level 2 Scotland on a Tuesday afternoon, in Perth Concert Hall, ears were flapping and hands were clapping. For the first time in a year, 2 months and 10 days, music was performed live in front of an indoor audience. Music that crucially involved that most contentious of COVID-era activities, singing. Around 100 tracked and traced, pre-booked ticket holders took their places at socially distanced tables, which replaced the hall's stall seating for the first of 4 lunchtime recitals under the banner Live and Unlocked, being broadcast live on BBC Radio 3 as part of a week of Scottish concerts. Cumbrian contralto Jess Dandy was accompanied by Edinburgh-born Herald Angel-winning pianist Malcolm Martineau. And if Miss Dandy suspected that she could have sung nursery rhymes in a few pages from the Tayside telephone directory and still won rapturous applause, she did not give in to that temptation. The singer, who is best known in Scotland for her work with the Dunedin Consort, presented a programme that began and ended in the 16th century, with the music of John Dowland, and covered the centuries in between with music-setting words from the 16th century, many of them written or inspired by Shakespeare. It was a very thoughtful and varied programme, showcasing a voice whose rich low notes are a rare treat on the modern concert platform, designed to demonstrate that her talents extend well beyond early choral repertoire. Perhaps unsurprisingly, after such a long layoff, she did not seem initially relaxed to be facing an audience on her own. The young singer quickly hit her stride. The French songs by Ravel, Poulenc, and the Shakespeare-obsessed Hector Berlioz. His ballad, The Death of Ophelia, ends wordlessly with plenty of the drama in the hands of Mr. Martineau, the most attentive of accompanists. Robert Schumann's settings of autobiographical verses by Mary, Queen of Scots, preceded a leap to 20th century composers and theatrical settings of the speeches of Shakespeare's Lady Macbeth by Joseph Horowitz, two of American Dominic Argento's settings of Elizabethan poetry, and three of Korngold's of songs from Shakespeare's plays. The Broadway flavour of those could have been the perfect way to end, but the musicians added a coda of farewell with Dowland's Now, O Now, I Need Must Part. They were, however, not permitted to leave without being cheered to the rafters. The audience may have been limited in size, but it clapped with enthusiasm until told to stop for a photograph to commemorate the occasion. By Keith Bruce.
The Herald, Friday the 28th of May 2021. News. Glasgow to offer drop-in COVID vaccinations for over 40s. This article is by Caroline Wilson. NHS Greater Glasgow and Clyde is to begin offering drop-in appointments targeting those over 40 who may have missed first or second doses of COVID vaccinations. The Health Board said it was working with local communities to better understand barriers that were leading to missed appointments following reports of high non-attendance rates at the Hydro Centre last weekend. It is to launch drop-in slots at West Glasgow Ambulatory Care Hospital from Saturday, the Hydro from Sunday, and community clinics across the city from Monday. NHS GGC said more than 98% of people over the age of 50 have now received their first dose. The Health Board said uptake rates remained very high, with a non-attendance rate of 16.5%. There has been a rapid acceleration of vaccinations in the south side of Glasgow, where cases have spiked, with younger people among those targeted. The First Minister is today due to announce if the city will be lifted out of Level 3 restrictions. A spokesman for NHS GGC said, "We want to thank everyone who has come forward for a vaccine so far. We've had incredible success to date, and this is a testament to the hard work of all those staff from across NHS GGC who have been involved in the rollout of the programme. Across our vaccine centres, vaccine uptake remains very high. Currently, non-attendance is at 16.5%. We are working with local communities to understand any barriers that people may face in taking up their appointment in a bid to address these. We will, over the next couple of weeks, be operating drop-in clinics at our community vaccination centres and the Hydro in order to enable members of the public aged 40 and over to receive first or second doses of their vaccinations." The Health Board said anyone who is offered an appointment at a clinic they cannot attend should call the helpline to rebook at a different time or an alternative location. This article is by Caroline Wilson. The Herald, Thursday the 27th of May 2021. News. Marks and Spencers steps up store closures following year-end loss of £201.1 million. This article is by Christy Dorsey. Marks & Spencer plans to further reduce its retail footprint with 30% fewer stores within the next decade. Speaking after the retailer posted a pre-tax loss of £201.1 million for the year end March 28th, Chief Executive Steve Rowe said the company is stepping up plans to close outdated stores to create a chain of 180 clothing and homeware sites across the UK, down from 254 at present. About 30 stores will gradually close over the next decade, while another 80 will be moved to better locations or merged with nearby shops. The group will open 17 new or expanded main stores in the next 2 years, including at least 6 at locations previously occupied by former rival Debenhams, which went into liquidation in December of last year. M&S has already closed or relocated 59 of its main stores, as well as cutting 7,000 jobs across the group. We are committed to stores and believe they can be a true source of competitive advantage, but they have to be the right stores in the right location with the right services, Mr. Rao said. Like many retailers, M&S has suffered under the enforced closure of shops to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. Its clothing and homeware sales slid by almost a third during the high street lockdowns, with a 54% increase in online sales failing to offset the 56% slump across its bricks and mortar portfolio. Collectively, clothing and homeware sales were down by 31.5%, accounting for most of the year's losses. However, that has improved since non-essential stores started opening across the UK, with overall trading in the 6 weeks since April the 3rd, ahead of the same period 2 years ago, prior to the pandemic. Excluding nearly £170 million of restructuring costs and £95 million on store closures, the business made a profit of £41.6 million. M&S received £175 million in business rates relief during the year and £131.5 million in furlough payments. Food sales rose by 1.3% at established stores, a lower pace than many rivals, though this has improved as its online take-up with specialist delivery service Ocado took effect from September. The company plans to increase its capacity to sell groceries online by 50% within the next 18 months, as its products now make up more than a quarter of the average order on Ocado. It also intends to invest in its food stores by creating 40 larger sites that appeal to families, up from 15 at present. In a year like no other, we have delivered a resilient trading performance, thanks in no small part to the extraordinary efforts of our colleagues, Mr. Rao said. In addition, by going further and faster in our transformation through the Never Same Again programme, we moved beyond fixing the basics to forge a reshaped Marks & Spencers. With the right team in place to accelerate change in the trading business and build a trajectory for future growth, we now have a clear line of sight on the path to make M&S special again. The transformation has moved to the next phase. Though the signs are encouraging, the company added that it remains unclear how the economic recovery will develop and whether consumer activity will be sustained. M&S said it also continues work to mitigate the ongoing disruption and material costs of Brexit, which it said has so far cost £16 million. It is currently looking at how to reconfigure its business in Europe and has already stopped selling chilled foods in the Czech Republic because of additional administrative and tariff costs. The group does not expect to pay a dividend this year as it continues to invest in its online business and store improvements. Underlying profits are expected to be at least £300 million, up from this year's £41.6 million, but down on the £403 million in the year prior to the pandemic. Shares in Marks & Spencer's closed yesterday, trading more than 8% higher, up 13.25 pence at 169.2 pence. This article is by Christy Dorsey. The Herald, Thursday the 27th of May, 2021. News. Perth-based SSE underlines appeal of Scottish wind farm licences. This article is by Mark Williamson. Energy giant SSE is making a bid to ramp up growth in the wind farm market off Scotland, significantly in a move it expects will provide a boost to the supply chain, which would be badly needed. Chief Executive Alistair Phillips Davies said the Scottish hydroelectric owner hopes to be one of the big winners in the forthcoming ScotWind licensing round, which covers huge swathes of the seabed off the country. "We'll bid in a number of areas," Mr. Phillips Davies told journalists, adding, "I very much hope we will be successful, as we're currently probably the most successful offshore wind builder in Scotland." Perth-based SSE finished development work on the giant Beatrice wind farm off Caithness in 2019. It is currently working on the Seagreen wind farm off the Angus coast. This will be Scotland's biggest wind farm when it is completed. The company came under fire after selecting operations based outside Scotland to produce turbines used on wind farms in the country. However, SSE has insisted its investment in renewables has helped generate lots of work for firms in Scotland, with resulting benefits for the jobs market. Mr. Phillips Davies defended the company's record yesterday. He said, "I see it as a big differentiator for SSE, our ability to try and bring more of the supply chain into the UK. That will certainly be part of our bid on ScotWind, is how about how we're going to support Scotland and support the supply chain in Scotland and the wider UK. By way of example," Mr. Phillips Davies noted, "we obviously got the announcement at Teesside earlier this year to get a blade factory built there by GE, and we're working on a number of similar opportunities. The factory concerned will create or support around 2,000 jobs. It will produce blades for the Dogger Bank wind farm that SSE is developing off North East England. Scotland has not enjoyed the kind of boost to the economy that was expected, given the potential to produce renewable energy in the country. The Burnt Island Fabrications BiFab business fell into administration in December after failing to win the kind of work associated with wind farm developments off Scotland that some hoped it would. After acquiring BiFab's site in Methil and Fife, Infrastrata won a contract to provide foundations that will be used on the Nart na Gaoth offshore wind farm project in the Outer Firth of Forth. This is being developed by EDF Renewables and ESB. The contract win is expected to result in around 300 jobs being created in Methil. In its annual results announcement, SSE said it was providing important support for the drive to achieve net zero in the UK while helping to power the recovery of the economy from the devastating impact of the coronavirus crisis. The group's chairman, Sir John Manzoni, said, "We are reducing emissions, investing in a green recovery, creating over 1,000 new jobs, making a major contribution to GDP, and financially, continuing to remunerate shareholders through delivery of our dividend plan." The group plans to invest around £2 billion this year in the development of renewable energy assets and related networks under a programme that will involve total spending of £7.5 billion to 2025. Mr. Phillips Davies said SSE expected to become a significant force in emerging markets such as carbon capture and storage and hydrogen fuel production, and saw opportunities overseas in countries such as the USA, Japan, and in Europe. SSE increased underlying profits before tax by 4% annually to £1.06 billion in the year to March the 31st. The impact of the coronavirus wiped around £170 million off profits against an expected £200 million. The group saw demand for energy from business customers fall and bad debts increase. SSE plans to sell its 33% stake in the SGN Gas Networks business this year. It sold its household energy supply business to OVO in January last year in a deal worth £500 million to focus on renewable power generation and related infrastructure. The group declared a final dividend of 56.6 pence, taking the full year total to 81 pence, in line with its plan to increase dividend payments in line with inflation in each of the 5 years to 2023. Shares in SSE closed down 8 pence at 1,542 pence. A spokesperson for SSE's renewables operation said the group had begun construction on 3 major wind farm projects in Scotland since the start of 2020, citing Seagreen and the Viking and Gordon Bush Extension onshore wind farms, which are in Shetland and Sutherland respectively. He said these low carbon projects are powering a green economic recovery right now through their support of more than 1,000 high value green jobs in Scotland, including director, contractor and supply chain roles. These include 141 skilled construction jobs at Global Energy's group's Port of Nigg in Tain, of which 48 are new roles being created to support the delivery of Seagreen offshore wind farm, as well as an expected 400 construction jobs at Peak on the delivery of our Viking project. This article is by Mark Williamson.
Friday, the 28th of May, 2021, the Herald Scotland sports section. Homecoming leaves Josh Taylor determined to help next generation. Josh Taylor hopes his performance in becoming undisputed world champion will help to inspire the next generation of Scottish boxers. The Southpaw returned to his hometown of Preston Pans earlier this week to a rapturous welcome. His only regret that he couldn't spend more time with those who had lined the streets because of quarantine guidelines. Taylor worries he's let people down by having to keep his distance ahead of a 5-day stint in self-isolation and hopes those who turned out didn't think he was being arrogant. He said, "The homecoming in Preston Pans was really cool. Driving back home, the streets were filled with familiar faces, friends, family, and so many people I've known for so long. There were a lot of kids there as well, all cheering me on, singing and dancing, making a big scene of it. It was really special. But I wanted nothing more than to just get out of the car and embrace them, join them in celebrations, go into the pub with them all and have a big party. I wanted to thank them all for their support. Instead, I had to stay in the car, wave and take a couple of quick selfies. I gave my dad a quick hug and lifted his hand up. Then I had to come away and come down the road, come home and just sit here. So it's been really cool, the response I've had from the media and everyone. But it's also been very deflating and frustrating as well. I felt as if I was being ignorant or something, like they might think I was being arrogant. All the kids were there wanting photos. I hung out the window of the car and took a couple of photos, shook a few hands. So it really stinks that I've had to come home and do this for the next couple of days. It's really, really frustrating. But he hopes the throng of youngsters who come out to greet him, as well as the thousands of others who have been following his adventures over in Las Vegas, will remember that moment when they set out on their own boxing journeys. And Taylor hopes he can now become more hands-on in his local community and beyond. It's all about inspiring future generations and younger kids, he added. I was a kid who looked up to Alex Arthur, Paul Appleby, Scott Harrison, and guys like that. They all inspired me to do what they were doing. I wanted to be involved in the big fights they were in. I watched them training and saw what was needed. For me, there's not a lot of opportunity for kids back home in Preston Pans, although It's a bit better now. But I want to inspire the kids. I've not got enough time for them, so I'd like them to make more time for them and see them more and speak to them. I'd like to kick back with them for 20 minutes or half an hour and even just see how they're getting on. I can try and guide them, although I can't say, do this and do that, but try and have a positive mind and a positive impact on them. The Scottish FA have offered Hampden as a possible venue for a future world title defence, and Taylor hoped he would perform better than his favourite football team, Hibernian. He added, I'd love to fight at Hampden, although that might just be a little bit too big. I know I pull in a good crowd, but could I sell 75,000 tickets? I don't know. That would be some feat, an achievement in itself. It's probably asking too much, but never say never. It would be really cool to fight there, though. Mike Tyson only drew 20,000, so there you go, but it could happen. I'd certainly like to hope so, because if that were announced, it would be amazing. Why not? I have some great support. Hopefully I'll do better than my team in the Scottish Cup final last weekend. They hibsed it, didn't they? But it is what it is. You win some, you lose some. Unless you're Josh Taylor, then you win them all. Friday, the 28th of May, 2021, the Herald Scotland sports section. Shelley Kerr, Scotland's Euro base has the perfect place to unwind between games. Scotland couldn't have chosen a better place to finalise the preparations for the European Championships. Steve Clarke and his players flew out to La Fincha in Spain yesterday for their training camp, and it is a destination I know well. It was where the women's team based ourselves for the Pinatar Cup last March, the tournament we were able to win right before the start of lockdown. Graeme Jones, who's the Scottish FA's head of high performance, came out with us for that one and was obviously impressed with what he saw and has recommended it as a base for the men's team ahead of the Euros. As a venue, we found it had everything we needed, and I'm sure Steve and his players will feel the same as they work towards Wednesday's friendly with the Dutch, the Luxembourg game, and then the finals themselves. It's walking distance to the pitches. The hotel is all mod cons. It's aesthetically pleasing on the eye and has all the comforts you need. It looks out onto a beautiful golf course, which I'm sure a few of the players will enjoy when they get some time off. I read Steve talking about making sure the players have enough to occupy them whenever they have some downtime, and I couldn't agree more. I'm a big believer that players need to feel their home comforts to help keep them relaxed and focused on the job in hand. We consulted with the squad before the World Cup about what they would like to do to keep themselves entertained. Players like to relax in different ways, and any squad will have a wide age range that will come and have different interests. I'm sure Nathan Patterson and Billy Gilmore at 19 will have different hobbies to those players in their 30s. So you have to cater for everything. In France, the big thing for us was Techball, which is a game played on a curved tennis table but using a football and your feet and hand instead of a bat. The girls played that a lot and ran many competitions to keep interest up. Some of them were on that table all day. Jigsaws were popular among some of the group, while we also ran quizzes and got everyone involved in them. We also had darts, table tennis, subbetio, and online gaming as well. Coffee is a big thing for players nowadays, so we got a proper machine so they could go and help themselves. Craig Brown also suggested that it might be useful to give the girls the chance to learn some French beforehand to get the locals on side. So a few enrolled for Babbel courses and got quite into that. You have to respect that there will always be some in a squad who are quite happy in their own company, reading a book or just chilling in their room. But my captain, Rachel Corsi, was brilliant at checking in on her teammates, making sure everyone was in a good place, and getting the more reluctant ones along to events just to have them part of the group. In France, we were based in three places, Nice, Rennes, and then Paris. We got the girls' favourite pictures put onto a canvas and had them put up in their rooms for them arriving, which was a nice touch by our commercial team. I said at the start I wanted the players to enjoy the experience as much as possible, so I gave them free time whenever I could. In Nice, I allowed them to have as much family time as possible. If I had the chance to do it again, I would maybe keep that to windows of downtime rather than the entirety, as it was maybe a bit too much free time in hindsight. Steve and his players won't at least have to deal with shifting from one place to the next with the squad based in Darlington for the duration. And they won't have the issue of allowing access to family and friends, as they're going to be in a bubble. So that's one fewer distraction. A little birdie has told me they're going to have a golf simulator in there, and I'd imagine the players will have put in other requests for what they want to do when they have time off. Before then, they have their first warm-up match against the Netherlands on the Algarve, and it will be interesting to see how Steve approaches it. Will he select players who won't start against the Czechs? I don't think so. I suspect he'll go with the core of the team and then make some changes as it goes along. One thing you might see is mixing up set plays. In our final warm-up game at Jamaica, I was aware that our World Cup opponents would be studying us closely. So for that game, we don't deploy any of our favoured routines at corners and free kicks. Steve might be thinking along similar lines ahead of these two warm-up matches. We're getting ever closer to the start of the Euros, and you can feel the excitement building across the nation. This trip to Spain will be vital for Steve and his players, just to make sure everything is as organised as it can be before the real action begins.
Herald Scotland, recorded on Friday 28th of May 2021. Arts and Entertainments. Rewild Scotland. Beavers in All Rivers, Lynx and Wolfpack. By Vicky Allen, Senior Features Writer. The rugged landscape of the Highlands is a place of loss. It has not been until relatively recently that we in Scotland have properly started to perceive that. For years it was just synonymous with the wild, nature's domain. What was missing was rarely on our minds, as we focused on sporting icons, the deer, the grouse, the heather. But now the monarch of the glen is being dethroned, and emphasis is being given to the nurturing and return of the other species, both those that are all too rare and those that are absent. Many species have disappeared over centuries, even millennia, mostly as a result of human impact. We don't notice their absence because we have never known them to be there. Two new books, Roy Dennis's Restoring the Wild and Andrew Painting's Regeneration, are testimony to the long list of flora and fauna that are missing in the project of bringing them back. At a time when rewilding is the buzzword, so commonly used, it's sometimes hard to get a handle on what it really means. Pioneers like Painting and Dennis are at the forefront of creating restorative change. They bring us stories of hope as well as alarm. Stories that are not just about the species themselves, but also we humans and what our presence should or could be like on the land. For among the species Andrew Painting feels is missing from the Highlands, or not quite in its rightful place, is Homo sapiens. Ornithologist and reintroduction pioneer Roy Dennis lists some of the large mammals which had roamed our lands since the last ice age, but are now long gone. The wolf, the lynx, the brown bear, the wild boar, the elk, the beaver, the auroch. There is a host of species missing, he says. There's a lovely skull of an auroch in our local museum in Forres. These animals, a kind of giant wild cattle, were around in the early millennia following the Ice Age in Britain. It was in the 1980s when I started talking to people in other countries. I began to recognise that because significant animals weren't there, our countryside was damaged. The beaver was probably the most important because it had such an impact on rivers. The 80-year-old is talking from his home in Moray, where he has just come in from his daily outing to check osprey nests to see if eggs have been laid yet. His email bears an automatic reply that says, "Raptor fieldwork season started from now to end July. We'll try to answer as soon as possible." Restoring the wild is testimony to his long-running battle to bring species back and a lifelong attitude of stubborn persistence. "I'm a great believer," he says, "in the idea that we just need to get it done. I'm afraid too many organisations now are just too big and they talk all the time. Talking rarely gets things done. No one thought we would be allowed to release white-tailed eagles in the Isle of Wight, nor did they think they could possibly live down there. And within 2 years, that's all changed. People are thrilled to bits having them there after 240 years of absence. One of my friends sent me a photograph today of one of the eagles lifting a fish out of the lake, a kind of coarse fish. It's brilliant that these birds have learnt so well to catch these things." Often these days, when we talk about rewilding, the impression is given that the best answer is just for humans to step back and let nature do its own thing. But Dennis points out, without help, the spread of animals like osprey and white eagles across the country is going to be infinitely slow. "We know that this natural spread is only 4 kilometres per year and that the male birds want to nest where they are reared. So when they come back from Africa after several years, they want to be near their natal sites. With white eagles, it's a bit more, about 10 kilometres. That means it could be 100 years for them to get back. Other species are still less likely to return on their own. With species like the lynx and the beaver, there's no way they can come back to Scotland unless humans bring them back. But you need to be able to demonstrate that you can do it properly to those who live and work there, and the farmers and landowners and foresters should have the respect that you know what you're doing and you get on with them." From youth, Dennis recalls being aware of the loss in British nature. He recalls how growing up in Hampshire, a nature-loving kid who loved to roam, he got into birdwatching and collecting eggs, as well as reading natural history books. On one occasion, he even took a trip to Culver Cliffs on a location he knew had been, in 1780, the last breeding site of the white eagle along the south coast of England. When, at 19, he was field ornithologist at the Fair Isle Observatory in Shetland, he heard stories of how there had once been 2 pairs of Erin's sea eagles on the island. They had last bred there on Sheep Rock before 1840. On Fair Isle, he would be involved in his mentor George Watterson's first failed attempt to reintroduce white-tailed eagles to the island. And since then, he's been instrumental in introducing white-tailed eagles, red kites and beavers to the UK, as well as increasing osprey numbers. As much as his book is a chronicle of the marvels of successful reintroductions and translocations, it's also a catalogue of attempted projects that get blocked at some stage or another. What's clear is that he expected far more animals to have been reintroduced by now. It's still a disgrace that the Scottish Government is not allowing us to restore the beaver to all river systems. And then, of course, looking at some of the predators like wolf and lynx. Lynx is the easiest one to do. We've known that since the early 1990s. We've not been able to get on with it. They have an impact on the animals like badger and fox and marten, and so on the middle predators whose numbers got so high that they damaged things like lapwings and oyster catchers and curlews and woodcock. Often we talk about biodiversity loss, we focus on the more charismatic mammals, but one of the biggest stories of loss is not so much of an individual species, but of a whole ecosystem, the Caledonian pine forests. Vast stretches of it, which once blanketed the land, have been replaced over centuries by moor and heather, and with it the homes of many a native species. Andrew Painting's book Regeneration is about one of the many experiments taking place across Scotland to bring them back. The restoration of the woodlands at Mar Lodge Estate, where he is assistant ecologist. My Lodge story is a fascinating one that I was drawn to when working in my own book, For the Love of Trees. Since the 18th century, the state has been managed for the sport of hunting deer. As a result, painting said, people were cleared from the land to make way for deer to hunt. And there were so many deer for such a long time that it was really more than the woods could cope with. Red deer really are a woodland species ultimately, he says. You find them in woods, but there were so many red deer at Mar Lodge for so long that the woods weren't regenerating. Whenever a pine tree or a young birch tree would raise its head above the heather, it would be nibbled back, and that happened for 200 years. Combine that with forestry events that happened in the 19th and early 20th century, particularly in the Second World War, large areas were lost, and you're looking at a steady attrition of what were once large connected Caledonian pine woods. Then in 1995, the estate was taken over by the National Trust, and a 200-year plan was developed, with three pillars of management: environmental conservation, sport, and access for everyone. Key in this was the restoration of woodland. What it started to do then was something quite extraordinary. The largest national nature reserve in the country, a formerly iconic sporting estate with royal connections, as painting puts it, just down the road from Balmoral, began to operate what it called a zero-tolerance campaign. It began to shoot not just a few of its deer, but a lot of them. This was at first hugely controversial, especially because at first there seemed few signs of the expected regeneration. It seemed like nothing was happening, but then after 10 years, signs became clear of the woodland returning. Since the start, that deer control policy, numbers in the area have been reduced from 3,500 to less than 2,000. The aim, painting says, was not to totally get rid of red deer. They are a really important woodland animal, and of course it's the largest nature reserve in the country. We want to have the UK's largest land mammal on the estate. It was just, as he points out, there were far too many. It took a long time to get that whole process right, and the Trust got a lot of criticism from both sporting interests and conservationists. The sporting interests were saying it was the end of red deer sport, and they were saying some pretty nasty things. On the other hand, you had conservationists saying, why aren't you pushing faster? It's a really tricky one because environmentalists don't want to kill things. We really like red deer. They're one of my favourite species, and you're left in this horrible position where you have to reduce their numbers. He's never shot a deer himself, but he says, been out stalking with the keepers. They don't trust me with a rifle, he laughs. They've seen me with a shotgun at the clay pigeon grounds and they've decided, nah, he's not good enough. I sort of made a point of going out with them though, because I feel like you can't go around advocating reducing deer numbers and not know what goes on behind that. Painting was not there for those early years of criticism. He first came to work at Mar Lodge as an assistant to groundbreaking ecologist Dr. Shaila Rao in 2016, at a point when the impact of the deer control was starting to result in a significant regeneration and increase in biodiversity. At that point, he started to ask, why aren't people talking about this as much as they should be? I thought we were sitting in quite a big landscape scale story and that the time had come for it. He felt this was a story of cultural significance that spoke of how Scotland's approach to the land could evolve. This was one of the first estates which you could call a Highland sporting estate, and one with royal connections just down the road from Balmoral. With all the history it has, I just thought the story had a lot of relevance for what the rest of the Highlands could look like in the future, if we want them to. Mar Lodge, he notes, is managed for the people of Scotland. I would like to see more land managed for the nation rather than for whoever happens to own them at any given moment. His own hopes for the future, not just of the estate, but of the Scottish landscape are, he says, I'd like to see a more joined up approach towards managing our landscapes. I'd like to see the word managing go out of fashion as well, and a move towards living with our landscapes rather than living on them or managing them. Going into the future, I would really like to see us bringing nature back and creating landscapes that is for nature and for people as well. The remains, he observes, of hundreds of shearlings and 8 illicit whisky stills have been found by archaeologists in glens there that were cleared. We too have disappeared in this area. Archaeologists have also found Mesolithic presence of humans going on at Mar Lodge. Basically, we can say that since the last ice age, deer, Scots pine and humans have been at Mar Lodge for the same amount of time. What's interesting about the kind of restoration that painting is talking about is the way that it envisions people as part of the system. What he says he would like to see is us there, but working with the land rather than managing it. It's about people living with nature rather than on top of it or against it. I think it's a case of shifting the goalposts of how you perceive the environment and our place in it. The ultimate end goal for the Mar Lodge woodland is to see trees, deer and people reunited. He describes what has been done at Mar Lodge not as rewilding, but landscape-scale ecological restoration. He even calls it pre-wilding. It's what you do before you start rewilding, and also the plan here started before rewilding was a term. I guess the problem with rewilding as a term to its detractors is that it suggests another level of Highland clearances, and I can absolutely see why people would think that. Wild does have connotations of danger and absence of people, but done properly, it can do the opposite. You just reframe people as being part of a wilder landscape. He also hopes that Mar Lodge, as well as being a showcase for woodland restoration and also demonstrate what a de-intensified sporting landscape could look like. Part of the estate, after all, is still managed for sport, but with a light touch. We've stopped Muirburn there, he says. We don't do much intensive management of it at all. That's quite challenging for some sporting folk because of a lot of the management is tied up in what the landscape looks like. So I think gamekeepers are keen in Muirburn because people have always done it. It's part of the sporting landscape. But if the SNP go through with their plans for licensing of grouse moor and changes to deer management legislation, then basically Mar Lodge is sort of showing what a de-intensified moorland and sporting landscape could look like into the future. I think that's something Mar Lodge is showing, that you can have a sporting landscape sitting alongside woodland regeneration, carbon sequestration, water retention, waders, hen harriers, you can have grouse shooting, and you can have hen harriers in the same moors. Talking to Dennis in painting, what comes across is both alarm and frustration, but also hope. Painting at 31 years old is one of a new generation of ecologists involved in shaping our future, and one of the delights of chatting with him is in hearing his positivity. It's there in descriptions of new orchids found in the estate or the growth in montane scrub. I forget, he says, about the declines in other places when I'm out and about. I was out this morning looking at hen harriers. I thought, oh, this is brilliant. We've got hen harriers everywhere. And then you start to look at raptorpersecution.com and find out that another two have been shot. This was another reason I wanted to write the book. Stories of hope are really important. It's important to know that how bad the situation is, but it's equally important so that you don't despair to know that there is hope for the future and that we can turn things around. Roy Dennis, meanwhile, at 80 years old, with a conservation career behind him of immense achievement, though clearly he is frustrated that more was not pushed through, he shares a few of his hopes and fears for the future. I think the situation over biodiversity and climate is critical. I think Scotland in that time will be a much more greatly wooded landscape. We won't have those bare hills, but they won't be replaced by Sitka spruce plantations. I'm talking about mixed woodland, which includes Scots pine and other things that can be harvested for wood. What I think we need is for 50% of the land to be managed to help with climate amelioration, preventing floods, holding water, creating oxygen, creating clouds, creating insects, all of that. I believe that 50% of the land and 50% of the seas need to have that special management. There's a faith there that this will happen. I do see that coming about, and I think I also. Beavers will be in all rivers in the mainland, lynx will be there, wolf will be back as well. Regeneration, the Rescue of a Wild Land by Andrew Painting is published by Birdlin. Restoring the Wild, 60 Years of Rewilding Our Skies, Woods and Waterways by Roy Dennis is published by William Collins. By Vicky Allen. Herald Scotland recorded on Friday, 28th of May 2021. Arts and Entertainments. Young Adult Book Review. Marion Lane and the Midnight Murder, An Inquirer's Mystery by Gemma McLaughlin. Marion Lane and the Midnight Murder, An Inquirer's Mystery. T.A. Wilberg, Orion, £11.99. What is the book about? In 1950s London, there's an organisation known as the Inquirers, who operate underground and solve mysteries. Who is it aimed at? This is perfect for any reader from age 12. What was your favourite part? The concept of the Inquirers and all their secrets added a new level to what was already an exciting mystery. What was your least favourite? As so many parts of this story were there to help set the scene for the future of the series, there were some details about the world building and character development that seemed incomplete. Which character would you most like to meet? Marion Lane was a unique and well-chosen character. Why should someone buy this book? Midnight Murder is the perfect start of to this new fantastical murder mystery series. By Gemma McLaughlin.
The Herald, Tuesday the 1st of June 2021. News. Clyde Waste to Hydrogen Facility Plan Unveiled. This article is by Brian Donnelly. Peel NRE, part of Peel LMP, is planning to develop a waste plastic to hydrogen facility in Scotland. The £20 million facility at Rothsay Dock on the north bank of the River Clyde, west Dumbartonshire, will take non-recyclable plastics destined for landfill, incineration or export overseas, and use them to create a local source of sustainable hydrogen. The hydrogen will be used as a clean fuel for buses, cars and HGVs, with plans for a linked hydrogen refuelling station on the site. The 13,500-tonne facility will be the second in the UK to use pioneering technology developed by Powerhouse Energy Group PLC, after plans for a similar facility at Peel NRE's Protos site in Cheshire were approved in 2019. The proposals will replace an existing planning consent on the site for a recycling centre and anaerobic digestion facility. Richard Barker, the director at Peel NRE, said, "We see a great opportunity to develop this leading-edge treatment technology, which will help efforts to create a green Clydeside by using end-of-life plastic to produce a clean vehicle fuel. We are also looking to create a fueling station to serve the new generation of hydrogen vehicles that will help reduce emissions and meet climate change targets." He said local councils are leading the way, and just this year Glasgow Council ordered 19 hydrogen-powered bin lorries, the largest such fleet in the world. This facility will convert plastic into hydrogen, a clean fuel that produces no emissions at the point of use, helping to improve local air quality. By co-locating a refuelling station, we can help to kickstart the infrastructure needed to support the rollout of hydrogen vehicles, which will be an important part of our journey to net zero. Tim Yeo, Executive Chairman of Powerhouse Energy, said, "We are delighted Powerhouse technology is to be deployed in Scotland, helping the region to improve air quality and provide a solution to end-of-life plastic. This new facility will play an important role in supporting the government's objective to make hydrogen a key element of Scotland's decarbonisation strategy. We welcome plans to co-locate a refuelling station at the site, which will help increase uptake of hydrogen fuel in the region and add to Scotland's growing hydrogen economy." All eyes are on Scotland ahead of the important COP26 meeting in Glasgow later this year, so we are delighted our pioneering clean energy technology will help put Scotland on the path to net zero. Zero Waste Scotland estimates that around 500,000 tonnes of waste plastic are produced in Scotland every year, with research undertaken by Anthesis on behalf of Peel NRE showing that around 300,000 tonnes are within the central belt of Scotland. In the coming months, Peel NRE will be consulting with the local community and stakeholders around the North Clyde site ahead of submitting a planning application to West Dumbartonshire Council later this year. Peel NRE has signed a collaboration agreement with Powerhouse Energy Group to develop 11 waste plastic to hydrogen facilities across the UK over the next few years, with the option of exclusive rights for a total of 70 facilities. This article is by Brian Donnelly. Tuesday, the 1st of June, 2021. News. SNP government plan for fairer workplaces falling woefully short, says report. This article is by Tom Gordon. The SNP's flagship employment programme is weak, limited and oversold, according to a leading Scottish think tank. The Jimmy Reid Foundation said the rhetoric behind fair work was not matched by action and it was improbable it would achieve its goal by the end of the parliament. It also identified an underlying falsehood in the government's own assessment of the scheme, with ministers taking credit for changes driven by other factors in society. It said trade union action had produced many more tangible improvements in workplaces than Fair Work, which was based on cajoling bosses to do the right thing. The think tank recommended the government use its purchasing power to insist on union recognition by all employers, getting public contracts to beef up the programme. SNP ministers said in 2016 they wanted to make Scotland a Fair Work nation by 2025. The Fair Work criteria are appropriate channels for effective voice, such as trade union recognition, investment in workforce development, no inappropriate use of 0 hours contracts, action to tackle the gender pay gap and create a more diverse and inclusive workplace, and providing fair pay for workers, such as paying the real living wage. The government argues these have to be achieved largely through encouragement, as employment law is reserved to Westminster. However, in the new report for the Jimmy Reid Foundation, Gregor Gall, visiting professor of industrial relations at the University of Leeds, said the SNP was unwilling to use the full array of state levers it had as a dissolved administration, citing the failure to set up an accreditation agency to verify whether employers offered fair work or not. Instead of compulsion through procurement, those wishing to bid for public contracts were merely expected to pursue fair work, with no penalty if they fell short. A vague definition of fair work also let employers off the hook. 5 years into the plan, less than a third of Scots workers are in unions, and around 15% of the workforce are still not paid the independent living wage. Professor Gall also accused SNP ministers of being prepared to take the credit for outcomes not necessarily driven by fair work, such as more firms paying the living wage and workplace changes brought about by trade unions. He said the policy was taking credit for developments that are, at best, not strongly or directly connected to it, and at worst, it has nothing to do with it. Scotland also remained relatively strike-prone despite fair work. The report concluded the SNP had used the state more to support capitalism than to reform or amend it in employment matters, and not because of the absence of devolved powers. It is evident that the SNP government believes it is sufficient to create a voluntary framework for labour and capital to operate within, and then let them get on with it, as per a classic collective laissez-faire perspective of minimal state intervention. Within this setup, the place of labour will always be at least second best. The government said, despite employment law being reserved to the UK government, we are doing all we can to work in partnership with unions, workers and employers across all sectors of the economy to build fairer and more inclusive workplaces. The Statement of Fair Work Principles, which we published last year, will help employers and employees make decisions that are in everyone's interest as we carefully reopen the economy. We continue to offer our sincere gratitude to workers and employers for reacting with such agility and dynamism to the challenges thrown up by the pandemic. This article is by Tom Gordon.
Recorded from the Herald on the 1st of June 2021, from the sports section. Scotland's John Fleck tests positive for COVID-19, by Mark Hendry. John Fleck has tested positive for COVID-19. The Scotland winger will therefore not travel to Portugal for his country's warm-up friendly against Holland this week. The SFA confirmed the rest of the squad have been retested for the virus, but all returned negative results. Fleck will now self-isolate. A statement read, the Scottish FA can confirm that John Fleck has tested positive for COVID-19 at the Scotland national team base camp in La Finca. As a result, he will self-isolate as per Spanish government guidelines and therefore not fly to Portugal for tomorrow's match against Netherlands. The rest of the squad was retested for COVID-19 and returned negative results today. More follows. That article was by Mark Hendry.
From the Herald Scotland, dated Tuesday, 1st June 2021. From the Voices section. Offence taken at geriatric millennial is just ageism. An article by Catriona Stewart. There was a recent generational squabble about punctuation in text messages. Apparently, putting a full stop at the end of a text message is rudeness, akin to violence for younger generations. I ask a 13-year-old about this and he says, "It's like you spat in my face." Another young person says that punctuation is a signifier of a fight. A neutral message contains no capital letters and no full stops. If an argument breaks out, you might use a capital letter to indicate annoyance. And if you're raging and really want to put your foot down, end the sentence with a full stop. No matter how deeply I think about this, I end up nowhere. How on earth is a full stop rude? Punctuation is, surely, the very essence of good manners, and the least you might show in respect to your conversational companion. This, you see, is a real generational divide. The author, Erica Darwin, recently wrote an essay based on a new book, Digital Body Language, describing just this, the markedly different ways we use technology depending on age. Using the term geriatric millennial to describe those born between 1980 and 1985, she described how this cohort make for the ideal employee, as they have experience of both analogue and digital worlds. These folk remember a time of fax machines, and know the world of 3D printers. They are as comfortable picking up the phone as they are on a Google Hangout. This resonated so strongly. When I started as a trainee reporter, the mantra was to be on the phone all the time. Hit the phones. You get the picture. In recent years, I noticed that younger folk, still like me millennials, but not of the 80s, will not pick up the telephone. I'm forever urging students and trainees to make phone calls rather than endless emails and DMs. What if I'm wrong? What if no one likes to answer the phone anymore? If I was Miss Darwin's classic geriatric millennial, I would have a better grip on this. While the micro generation resonated with me, for many it was a division too far. Understandably, people aren't keen on labels, stereotypes and generalisations. Millennial is a particularly loose term. I'm a millennial, but so is my cousin's 21-year-old son. As far as generational life experiences go, we have pretty much nothing in common. People are particularly affronted about being pigeonholed by age when it comes to birth year labels. Again, quite right. The 70-somethings of my acquaintance are still working, still adventuring, still as engaged as they were 20 years ago, and not a shampoo and set in sight. A pensioner now is not the same as a pensioner of my grand generation. But that somewhat misses the point. It's not about age, it's about experiences. While some baby boomers are happily embracing being elderly, others are carrying on regardless of age. Yet they all have shared experiences younger people will never really understand. My fellow 1980s babies know what it's like to grow up without a mobile phone, say. The relief of not having your teenage years documented in a million selfies, but in just enough photos to fill a MySpace page. The major affront at geriatric millennial seemed to be towards that first word, geriatric. How dare anyone make the suggestion that we're old? What's so bad about being old? This seems rank ageism. This outrage merely at tying people of the early 80s to a word meaning old. I had my second coronavirus vaccine on Sunday morning, and the vaccinator asked me if my year of birth was 1962, which would, and apologies if you've already done the maths, make me about to turn 60. When she looked up and spotted my relatively smooth brow and only mildly lined eyes, she could not have been more apologetic. There's a separate piece to be written about ageing and the different expectations placed on age groups now. But putting an end to the taking of offence at the mere idea of being associated with advanced years is a stance multi-generations should unite behind. This article is by Catriona Stewart. From the Herald Scotland, dated Tuesday, 1st June 2021, from the Voices section. The Five Key Truths We Now Know About Scotland and the Union. An article by Neil McKay, writer at large. Attempting to establish the truth in Scottish politics is a difficult business. One person's black is another person's white, depending on where they sit along the independence unionist axis. Everything is disputable, everything open to doubt, everything can be politicised. But there are little areas of agreement we can settle upon, whether we're pro or anti-independence, and it's important to try to establish this common ground if we're to engage in any meaningful discussion about Scotland's constitutional future. Without some trusted points on the map, we'll be lost in a confusion of our own making. There seems to be five areas of agreement starting to establish themselves. They appear to break down as follows. Number one, Tory disrespect has fuelled independent support. The word disrespect will likely alienate those of unionist bent, but it's difficult to argue that Brexit and the lack of consideration for the majority of Scottish public opinion wasn't a smack in the face. The union is meant to be a matter of consent, not coercion. To save unionist supporters taking offence at the word disrespect, let's say instead that the Tory government failed to consider and act upon the majority of Scottish public opinion. A wrong can be done passively as well as actively. Negligence can be wounding. Couple this disrespect, negligence if you prefer, with the dismissal by Boris Johnson's government of the Scottish election, presenting a democratic mandate for a second referendum, and the sense that Scotland is being controlled against its will becomes even greater. Number two, the case for independence needs remade. If we accept that Mr. Johnson's government has changed the nature of the union from consent to control, and that a mandate for a second referendum exists, then surely there should be a refreshed independence prospectus. The case for independence hasn't been adequately updated since Brexit. Brexit clearly increased independence support, but it also changed the nature of what independence means. Before Brexit, there was no question of a hard border with England. Now, that prospect is real. Nor has the economic case been improved. Support may hover around 50%, but in the polling stations, much of that support could evaporate if the Yes movement, and the SNP in particular, given it's effectively subsumed much of the Yes movement, doesn't address hard economics. Currency, the cost of separation, the divisions of the marital assets and debts, pensions, EU re-entry and the euro. The list of unanswered economic questions goes on. While it's the economy which will make up most people's minds, the other great unanswered questions hover like Banco's ghost too. NATO, Trident, the military, the intelligence services. The SNP's independence task force is shambolic. Established with the intention of firing up the Yes movement, it's a Potemkin village. The task force head, former SNP minister Marco Biaggi, has quit, reportedly because the role was the worst job ever. The SNP remains riven with toxic internal feuds. More proof, if it were needed, that entrusting a project like independence to one self-interested political party is both dangerous and absurd. Number three, if independence fails again, it fails forever. There's a sense that Mr. Johnson will relent at some point, probably when he sees Yes sliding in the polls, and grant a referendum. If he does, and if the case for independence hasn't been well made, especially amid such clear goading by Mr. Johnson's administration, then it's all over for at least a generation. Veteran SNP MP Pete Wishart warned much the same at the weekend. If the Yes movement fights and loses IndyRef 2, independence will retreat to the sidelines, becoming a minority sport. That'll spell disaster for the SNP. What would be the point of the party any longer? Nor could the SNP continue to use its constant sleight of hand to distract voters from its many failings in office by pointing at wicked Westminster. Number 4. Life inside this new union will be tough. Whether or not another referendum is fought and lost by the Yes movement, it's clear Scotland faces life inside a very different union. If we agree that London is now exercising much less consideration towards Scottish views, then that will only ramp up in the wake of a failed IndyRef 2. Holyrood will increasingly be told what to do, or perhaps more, what not to do. There's a hint of that tougher future in the looming Supreme Court hearings over whether Scotland has the authority to issue certain types of legislation. Two bills incorporating the UN Rights of the Child and the European Charter of Local Self-Government are to be scrutinised in court over whether they overreach Holyrood's powers. The UK government has also ordered Scotland to inform London of all contact with the EU. Expect more of the same. Number 5. The Tory government will get nasty with Scotland. Mr. Johnson isn't going to be gentle with Scotland. He's not David Cameron. Mr. Johnson's muscular unionism intends to put Scotland in its place. The English electorate, broadly, and Tory voters in particular, aren't in an especially loving mood towards Scotland. They probably want to see a little hardball with Edinburgh. If a second referendum does materialise, then discussions over the shape of that vote won't be the cosy chit-chat that led up to 2014. They'll be brutal. If a yes vote happened, prepare for horror show negotiations as the UK tries to hammer Scotland into submission. So life either in or out of the Union will become very different, politically, from what we've known. Here then are perhaps a few points on the map we can agree on. Mr. Johnson's new style Tory party has driven support for independence, yet the case for independence has been insufficiently made and needs updating. If we do get another referendum and there's a no vote, it's all over, probably for a generation. No matter what happens in terms of Scotland's constitutional future with England, the relationship with London has changed from one of consent to control, and it looks certain Westminster will be much tougher with Scotland than before. It's not much of a map, but if we agree on those points, we can at least try to navigate our way towards the future in a meaningful, informed fashion. This article was by Neil McKay.
And that was this week's The Herald podcast, normally recorded in our studio at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre, currently recorded from our volunteers' homes with the publisher's kind permission. Thanks for listening.